and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 18th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is John DeGraff. Today's session is titled, Television and Social Change, Stewards of Creation. Let's listen in.
In a place like Holden, I think all of our thoughts at one point or another turn to the beauty of the environment around us. And tonight's theme is really an environmental theme. I call it Stewards of Creation because I think we're all called upon to be stewards of God's creation and preserve and protect and in some cases restore this wonderful world around us. And this place, Holden, has a little bit of an extra meaning for me in terms of the environment. I'm actually known sort of around in the producing world as more of an environmental filmmaker than anything else, even though I do a lot of different subjects. I think many people think of me as an environmental filmmaker, so this is environment night. But one of the things that has made the first I ever heard of Holden was in a book. And the book was called Encounters with the Archdruid. Anybody read that book or heard of the book? Written by John McPhee, who's a pretty well-known author. And it's called Encounters with the Archdruid, A Conservationist and Three of His Natural Enemies. And the book starts at Holden. And it's the story of David Brower, who was until his death last November, probably the most prominent environmentalist in the world, and certainly the most prominent in the United States. And in the book, the book begins at Holden when David Brower and his natural enemy, according to John McPhee, a geologist named Charles Park, take a walk up Railroad Creek and out over Cloudy Pass into the Glacier Peak wilderness area. And Mr. Park, the geologist, wants to make another copper mine, like this one, right by Cloudy Pass. And this was a plan for a long time in the Kennecott Copper Corporation. They had the mining rights. They were going to build a huge open pit mine, not a tunnel mine, but an open pit mine that would be big enough actually to see from the moon. They were going to put it right by Cloudy Pass. And John McPhee's book takes Brower on this excursion, and we kind of, in this trip, he got these two guys to actually go on this backpack trip together, and we sense the conflict that they have about values and about, you know, what's more important, getting out copper or saving a beautiful place. And then later on, he goes with a developer on one of the South Carolina Sea Islands, and finally, in the last part of the book, he goes down the Grand Canyon in a boat with a man named Floyd Dominick, who's the secretary of the Commissioner of Reclamation under the Bureau of the Interior, and who wanted to build power dams in the Grand Canyon. David Brower didn't want to build power dams in the Grand Canyon, so you've got that conflict as well. But briefly, I think everyone ought to have a hero, and David Brower was my personal hero. I first met him back in 1972, and then again in 1980 when I asked him if I could do a documentary film about his life and work. And he said yes, and we got to work on it, and we filmed a little bit of it, and I ran out of money quickly and wasn't able to raise any more, and the project languished for some time, and I'm sure he thought it would never get done, and I thought it would never get done. And then in 1987, a friend of mine actually went to work for David Brower, and she said, you gotta do that film. It's more important now than ever, and this guy's story is a really important one. And I thought, yeah, I should try again. But at the time, I had a little bit more of a track record as a producer, and I thought maybe it would be a little more possible to get the funding I needed to make the program. So I called up David Brower one day. I was in Berkeley at a BART station. Many of you have been in the Bay Area, you know BART is the underground subway system in the Bay Area. I was at a BART station in Berkeley, and I had David Brower's home phone number. So I called him up, and he answered. And I said, you know, you probably won't want to remember me, but this is John DeGraff, and I remember you, and I wanted to make a film, and I'd really like to begin again, and I really think this time I can make it happen. You know, I was kind of expecting him to hang up. But instead he said, okay, where are you? And I said, well, I'm actually in Berkeley. Well, where in Berkeley? So I know the bar station. Well, hang on there, and I'll be down to meet you in about 10 minutes, and I'll take you to lunch. So we went to Spengler's Fish Grotto in Berkeley. Some of you who are Berkeleyites or Bay Area people probably know that place. They happen to be one of Dave Brower. He likes fish restaurants in general. And we talked, and eventually the film got made. It's called For Earth's Sake, The Life and Times of David Brower, and PBS used it as its National Earth Day special in 1990, for the anniversary of Earth Day in 1990. And I'll just run briefly a little bit about David Brower's life. Incidentally, this particular film, which I'm going to show a short clip from tonight, will be shown for anybody who wants to see it in its entirety tomorrow at 1 o'clock here. But Dave Brower was who grew up in Berkeley, California, and became an active hiker and mountain climber in the Sierra Nevada mountains as a young man, and got active very early on in the Sierra Club, where he met Ansel Adams and became friends with a number of these people, and became one of the leading mountain climbers, rock climbers of his day. And during World War II, actually trained the U.S. Mountain Troops and was one of the officers in the U.S. Mountain Troops who fought against the Nazis in some famous battles in Italy. And then in 1952, he was chosen to be the first paid executive director of the Sierra Club, which at that time was still a small organization, had about 5,000 members. It was basically a California hiking club. And Brower was determined to change that. He was determined that the Sierra Club was going to be a force to preserve wild places, and that people who enjoyed those places had an obligation to save and to protect them for future generations. He hadn't yet become a full-blown environmentalist. He was mostly about saving the wilderness. And right off the bat, he got involved in a battle, because at that time, some members of Congress wanted to put power dams in a place called Dinosaur National Monument in the Colorado-Utah border. Some of you may have been there. Would have flooded that national monument. And Brower led a fight to stop that from happening, and he was successful. But he was successful in a compromised fashion. He agreed if the government would abandon the plans to build these two dams in the Dinosaur National Monument, that he and the Sierra Club would not oppose another dam down the Colorado River at a place called Glen Canyon. And so Glen Canyon Dam was built, and Brower had never been to Glen Canyon when he agreed to this compromise. And he went there shortly before the dam was completed and the water started filling the canyon. And when he saw the beautiful place that was going to be lost, it really kind of broke his heart. And he felt that he had made a terrible mistake to do this, to let this place be damned and destroyed. And so he was determined not to do that sort of thing again. I'm going to show a clip from the film For Earth's Sake. And it starts with Brower's work on what was called the Wilderness Act. It set aside created a lot of the wilderness areas that exist in the United States today. And then it goes into his work here in the North Cascades area to create North Cascades National Park. And then his fight, another later fight concerning the Grand Canyon. And Dave Brower died, as I mentioned, last November. He was 88 years old. I think people had a more active and fulfilling life and did more. I happened to have the opportunity to see him about 5 days before he died. And of course, it was an extremely hard thing for me. He was in the hospital and everything. But I think his work is being carried on by many people, and where maybe in the 50s there was one Dave Brower leading the way, I think that an awful lot of people now have gotten the environmental message and are carrying it on. So let me show this clip from For Earth's Sake, The Life and Times of David Brower.
Of all people. On a midsummer morning, Anne and David Brower visit the Hoover Wilderness Area, just east of Yosemite National Park. It used to be said of David that if you put him down at night anywhere in these mountains, in the morning he'd know exactly where he was.
Here we are at North Peak, which is not named after Oliver Norton.
He's just trying to do it.
I went there to be out in real mountains and surrounded by mountains of paper.
The smallest little thing, just to confess me, you think about things new with the way you live with a small child.
These are known as fairy circles. Long before our human beings began a cut and burn philosophy of going to the environment and moving on beyond what they spoiled, grasses were doing it. And the area behind this circle is where the grass has been, and it's probably much exhausted in nutrients there, so it's moving on for more to just experience the wildness of the ages of the perfect. That's the thing I like. Civilization, but all those elements came together in wilderness, and very little there wasn't anything but wilderness on Earth.
On September 3rd, 1964, President Johnson signed the National Wilderness Preservation Act, setting aside 9 million acres of pristine country. It was the culmination of a long campaign in which David again played a major role.
Howard Zonmeister was the leader in that, and I think possibly I was one of his chief assistants. We were talking about a wilderness bill back in the 30s and finally presented the first draft of a wilderness bill in the mid-50s. 9 years later, we got it.
Presently, 90 million acres, most of them in Alaska, are officially classified as wilderness. These are the last sanctuaries where all generations to come can discover the American Earth, essentially as it was before Columbus.
No one should be deprived of what goes on here, a chance to see what makes it worth, to see the beauty of it all hours of the day. God has made us. We can't make you. They can only revere it and spare it.
This is Stehekin Landing, gateway to one of the most magnificent wilderness areas in the United States. Here, on a summer weekend in 1988, backpackers come by boat en route to the rugged trails of North Cascades National Park. Dave Brower arrives here too, for a reunion with some of the people who worked hard to create the park 20 years earlier. It was a long effort.
You bring bad weather. I don't know why you have to do this. Well, I don't have anything here. The rain all over.
Back in 1956, Grant McConnell was a college professor who spent summers in Stehekin. Alarmed by the effects of mining and logging in the area, he took his concerns to David Brower.
It was not a difficult matter to persuade him that this place needed help.
Fresh from his dinosaur triumph, Brower suggested a film to show people what should be preserved. Then he brought his camera and his oldest sons to the North Cascades.
We used to always complain, my brother and I, because we were sort of pressing the service of models in these movies. We we have to do is the same routine 3 or 4 times to get it right.
Brower's boys and Grant McConnell's daughters starred as every child who might someday enjoy these mountains.
Up where the trees reach as high as the crown, where the flower takes the summer winds of beauty, and the summer rain too. They will want to discover for themselves the wildness that the ages have made perfect.
I myself showed that film at least 100 times, and always had large audiences that were just enthralled with it. And I was always convinced that they were going right home to write the congressman.
The battle continued into the 60s. Timber and mining companies proved powerful adversaries. As government hearings on the issue approached, Brower looked for yet another way to persuade a reluctant Congress.
He wanted a book desperately, so he called me on the phone one day and said, how are you going to write a book? I got to have it in 30 days.
The Wild Cascades was given to every member of Congress to show the congressman exactly what was at stake in North Cascades. And I can't help but think that had a major impact.
One of the critical issues in this county.
All right, yes. And where is your mean typewriter?
After 12 years of effort, Congress created North Cascades National Park.
Without Dave, there wouldn't be a park. He knew the national organization. He knew everybody. And if he decided that there was to be done, he knew what buttons to push and how to push them and get things going.
At the same time as the Sierra Club was defending the North Cascades, there was a stretch of the Colorado River that was still wild. But there was also a man in a powerful position who wanted to change that.
I would develop every possible hydroelectric site all over the United States.
In 1963, the year Glen Canyon Dam was completed, Commissioner of Reclamation Floyd Dominey announced plans to build 2 more power dams on the Colorado, this time in the Grand Canyon itself. Horrified, Brower attacked. His first weapon was a book of stunning photographs lamenting the death of Glen Canyon and warning that Grand Canyon dams would do irreparable damage to one of the wonders of the world. He sent a copy to Interior Secretary Udall, Floyd Dominey's superior.
I was working for Stuart Udall when the book, Place Nobody Knew, arrived and went over the pictures of what was in Glen Canyon. He shook his head and he almost wept and he said, you know, I was in Congress when we voted for this dam. We had no idea what was there.
But Floyd Dominey countered with a film celebrating the reservoir that replaced Glen Canyon. Johnson and the congressional delegations of every western state. Never had the Sierra Club faced so powerful a foe.
One of the posters the Sierra Club put out was a poster of Mount Everest. In the bottom of that poster, I put the little lines from Girty. Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it.
Boldly, with full-page newspaper ads, Brower charged that one of the proposed dams would inundate Grand Canyon National Park.
There is no other Grand Canyon, and Grand Canyon's highest purpose is for it all to be protected for all people, forever.
Dave Brower deliberately misled the public. He had people believing we were going to have a lake in Grand Canyon National Park up to the brim. He knew better than that, but he did it.
technically, Dominey was correct. Most of the flooding would have occurred in areas of the Grand Canyon outside the national park. But the living Colorado, the wild river that dug this chasm, would be silenced forever. Public opposition to the Grand Canyon dams mounted, and when proponents argued that a reservoir in the canyon would offer easier access to its glories, Browner responded with a vengeance. He ran more newspaper ads ridiculing the plan. They were referring to public protests from the Bureau of Reclamation.
It did stampede a lot of people. I'm sure it made many members of Congress reluctant to go against the tons of mail that were flowing in, even though they knew that it was inspired mail from a false point of view.
In the end, Udall declared his opposition to the dams. And in the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River still runs free.
One of the most important things for any public official is to be open-minded. And Brower helped me see things in a different light. And in that sense, I'm in his debt, no question about it.
The Grand Canyon, saved. The North Cascades, saved. Concurrently, the sea.
When are they going to flood the Sistine Chapel?
I don't know. There was some David Brower type character back there in the 1600s who could get on that perhaps. We don't know his name. I'd make a film about him if I knew his name. Sorry. Well, again, interrupt any time if anybody has any questions, but I'll go on to the next clip. Long before we were here as Europeans in this environment and trying to preserve it, the Native Americans throughout the United States and here in the Pacific Northwest had a concern and an ethic of stewardship toward the land and the animals, the wildlife, flora, fauna, and so forth. And that still carries through their traditions. I had the opportunity in 1991 to do a documentary about Indian tribes in the western part of Washington State and their environmental activities and environmental concerns. And one of the concerns that the tribes have always had here in this area is about the destruction of our old growth forests and the impact of that on streams and, of course, on the trees themselves and so forth. So I went with two Indian activists from the Lummi tribe, which is a reservation near Bellingham, Washington, and followed them around in their campaign to try to get people to stop cutting old growth timber in that area. So I'm going to show you a clip from a program called The Moon's Prayer. The title actually comes from a Northwest Indian story that is passed down and I first heard in a longhouse on Tulalip Indian Reservation. It says that if you look at the full moon in the night sky, you look at the dark part, the shadow on the moon, that what it is and what it looks like, and look at that sometime, you'll notice is an Indian who is kneeling, who's bent down, and his feathers are coming this way. He's praying. And he's praying for the earth and asking the Great Spirit to get people to protect the earth and to take care of it. So this is a clip from The Moon's Prayer.
The story of Sandarons is not the only struggle facing contemporary Northwest Indians. this 600-year-old cedar tree is worth thousands of dollars, so the tree is being cut down. Such trees are now scarce.
And we were asked to put together some canoes for the 100-year centennial of the state. We had a difficult time finding cedar trees large enough to make canoes out of. Told one of the timber boys that we couldn't find a tree big enough to sit in.
Today, timber industry practices show greater environmental awareness than those of the past, but some Indian leaders believe more change is needed.
Everything down here that we bought, Boulder Creek, is 100% lost because they clear cut all above it and they blew the creek out.
Ken Cooper of the Lummi tribe monitors timber harvesting along the forks of the Nooksack River near the Canadian border.
Right now, they're clear cutting right Oak Creek, which is all on a stable slope.
Cooper and fellow Lummi activist Jewel James oppose continued clear cutting on hillsides like this one above the Nooksack. They take their concerns on the road, stopping to speak with local residents.
And so when we started seeing this happen on this side of the dike, we were very upset about it.
It's pretty hard to do anything to stop them, but it doesn't take a genius to figure out what that's going to do that river.
James and Cooper have seen salmon streams destroyed when heavy rains cause mudslides on clear-cut slopes. They believe in selective cutting, leaving enough trees standing to hold the soil.
Economically, we all pay when you have clear cuts. And when you have high mountainous areas such as we have here in the Northwest, you have a lot of unstable slopes. And it's just a matter of time and weather, those slopes are going to give way.
We've got a mile and a half. This is actual land that used to be up in the mountain. We've got 1 mile and a half of land that wasn't here before.
Cooper says sediments, eroding from clear-cut hillsides, are carried by the Nooksack into Bellingham Bay.
When I was a child, we could ride out here about a half mile down and deep clams. Now there's nothing there but sawdust and silt.
The Nooksack River begins here in Cascade Mountain snowfields.
The mountain range is a place where we'll be fast, where we're headed deep and green. The rivers and streams and all along through this mountain range we need for a spiritual being, and each area has a different kind of a gift for traditional people. There's lots of medicine and all that plant life that the Creator put here.
We still believe it is the Garden of Eden.
There's a lot of people in the cities that will never ever enjoy this forest, but that does not mean that they or their children do not have a right to come here someday and experience some of nature in its finest.
Along the Nooksack, Jewel James and Ken Cooper still follow the spiritual path of their ancestors. Their temples are the old-growth forests, worth more, they say, to the spirit in this artificial age than they will ever be worth as lumber on the market.
Some of these trees are just saplings when Columbus landed here. So these trees are full of knowledge. They see lots in their time, and they've got lots to offer poor people like us. When we come and sit beneath these trees, we ask them for some of their power, ask them for some of their knowledge. This is our way of life, where we're standing. This is where we come and practice and talk. We talk to these trees. You take the drum and you listen to this background noise of the river, and hold it in your hand and start imitating what you're hearing, and you'll pick up a song.
In his spare time, Jewel James fashions art from antlers, gifts from Indian hunters who don't want to waste any part of the animal. His inspiration is the magic of nature.
I cannot force the piece to be something other than it is. I really believe that. I think it's got its own spirituality about it. But it also symbolizes the relationship of humankind's connectedness to the other animals, the other spirits in the world around us. Here we have a killer whale, a salmon, and a wolf up here, and two more killer whales, raven and the sun. Part of this magic is actually dying today.
Lights, please.
Thank you.
Are they still clear cutting?
Well, in various places, definitely. Oh, yeah, it certainly has not stopped as a forestry practice, although there has been some progress. But that kind of does lead into the next, that question leads into the next thing that I'm going to show you a bit of. This was not is a program I'm currently working on. Actually, this is a finished small piece that I'm hoping to turn into a larger one-hour documentary. And it's about a subject called certified wood. And you may have heard of certified wood, although most people, I think, haven't. But if you go into stores and buy wood, in some places you'll see wood that has a little logo on it. It's like a tree, and it says FSC, and it says certified. And that means that an independent international organization has found that the forest from which that wood comes is being managed and harvested in a sustainable way. Not only that, but that fair wages are being paid to the people who work there, and the concerns of the community are also being taken into account. So I did a little video just for a conference that's happening next week in Atlanta, Georgia. It's an international conference on certified wood. And it's a story of a few of the companies who are actually starting to practice logging in a different and more sustainable way. There's an interesting story behind this, and that is that three states so far have officially moved toward certification. It's state policy to try to certify their public forests, the public lands that the state manages in New York, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota. And it was about to be state policy in Washington to do the same thing under the previous commissioner of public lands, Jennifer Belcher. She had moved a long way in that direction. She had a whole staff working on certification. And the interesting thing is that when she didn't run for re-election, and the person who won the election and replaced her, his first act, this is something you never read about in the newspapers, was to cut the certified forest program. And that was done at the behest of the Weyerhaeuser Corporation, which does not want to go toward certification. Now, another irony in all of this is that Weyerhaeuser British Columbia is fully certified and believes it. And what that came from is that in the early 90s, there were enormous protests on the coast of British Columbia over terrible logging practices and clear cutting by a company called McMillan Blodell. And Mac Blow, as it's called in Canada, actually responded to that public pressure, and it moved toward much more sustainable forestry practices and toward getting its forest certified by the Forest Stewardship Council, the international body that does that, and had gotten a long, long way in that direction. Was very committed to it. Well, Weyerhaeuser bought McMillan Blodell 18 months ago. So, and what's happened is that the Weyerhaeuser BC Coastal Group, which is what McMillan Blodell is now called, is certified, and strong advocates of the whole principle of certification and sustainable forestry, while Weyerhaeuser here in the state of Washington remains the prime opponent to the same thing. So this is a little piece called Where Does Your Wood Come From? And I'm going to show for such a 7 minutes of it.
Certification, in my view, is the savior of the forest products industry.
There's a transformation occurring in America's forests and stores.
We're going to move towards as much certified wood as possible, as quickly as we can.
It could save jobs, communities, and the environment.
This truly is a win-win situation.
All the companies that are taking on certification are really harvesting and managing their forests in the most ecologically sensitive ways you can imagine, and they are making money.
first glance, it seems like any busy office. But this modest suite in Portland, Oregon is actually the nerve center for a peaceful revolution. It's the office of the Certified Forest Products Council, a nonprofit organization that is uniting former adversaries in search of sustainable timber practices.
You had leaders in the environment community and leaders in the forest products industry that really needed a place where they could come together on neutral territory and craft a new way forward. And the Certified Forest Products Council essentially was the table where that deal was cut.
We're trying to create a broad middle ground, and we're trying to use the marketplace as the driver here in a collaborative fashion.
David Ford worked for the timber industry while the infamous Spotted Owl controversy raged in the Pacific Northwest.
It was us versus the environmentalists, and we really lost that battle. And I guess I learned some lessons from that process and concluded that there had to be a better way to go about trying to work to find some resolution to these issues.
Damaged watersheds and ugly clear cuts resulted in public demands for better forest management. Like David Ford, Jeff Wortel, an environmentalist, had grown tired of rhetoric.
And I was being advised by others that wood was not an environmental material. And that to me just flies in the face of common sense, because wood has so many valuable environmental attributes. It's fully biodegradable, it's entirely non-toxic, it's totally renewable. So there's a lot of good environmental reasons to use wood.
Jeff and David looked for a way to bring the warring parties together, and they learned about an idea called forest certification.
This is the first tool I saw come along in my 20-plus year career, which I looked at and said, hey, this kind of changed the dynamic of the discussion here.
This basin looks great. This is a voluntary program with a set of guidelines and a rigorous assessment process.
You guys seem to be doing a good job of it out here.
Larry Nussbaum conducts timber audits for Smartwood, an independent forest certification company.
Synthesizes what we do during a forest management assessment is bring in a team of interdisciplinary experts to look at the various aspects of forest management. So on a team you might have a forester, a wildlife biologist, ecologist, a fisheries specialist, depending on the unique circumstance of the site. The idea is that what's left behind after timber harvest is a fully functioning forest.
They also consider working conditions, labor rights, and impacts on local communities or indigenous people.
Our phones ringing off the hook from folks saying, hey, how do I get involved in this? What do I have to do to get certified and get my products to market?
The guidelines Larry Nussbaum uses for certification were set by the Forest Stewardship Council, an international organization based in Oaxaca, Mexico. An FSC logo on the product means the forest it comes from meets the most stringent worldwide standards blending social, environmental, and economic needs.
And what we want to ensure is that workers are being treated fairly and the community's interests are really being taken into account. We're really looking at the viability of the company. Are they really shortchanging the local community, the environment, at the expense of some type of short economic return?
The customer, the end user, can really feel confident when they see that FSC trademark on the lumber or whatever product they're buying.
Jane Francis is the forest manager for Collins Pine Corporation, the first FSC-certified timber company in the United States.
The overall objective is to leave the stand in better growing condition after we finish our harvesting process than it was when we started.
Collins foresters selectively harvest trees from diversified stands of pine, fir, and cedar. They've been through here several times, but you never know it by the looks of the forest.
The trees range in age all the way from zero all the way up to about 350 years old. We've got some old growth trees on just about every acre of the forest. The trees that we leave provide the seed base.
They also leave snags, logs, and woody debris for wildlife, and they carefully protect watersheds. When Collins bought this forest in 1941, it contained 1.5 billion board feet of wood. Since then, the company has harvested 2 billion board feet. Yet, 1.5 billion still remains in the forest. That's brought respect and praise from environmentalists and from other forest product companies.
I am the envy of all my peers who work in a forest like this. I feel like I have the best job in the world. I feel extremely blessed to work for a company who not only expects but demands that we take good care of the forest.
Don Hansen feels the same way. He works down the road from Collins Pine for the world's largest supplier of plywood.
I see myself as a logger and an environmentalist. I love the environment enough to where I made it my life's work. And I feel the two are compatible.
Roseburg's California forest is also FSC certified. It wasn't easy because company foresters had used herbicides to restore fire-damaged lands. The certifiers required justification.
They didn't feel that herbicide use was compatible with a lot of their ideas of sustainable forest management. But after looking at the problem, they realized that some prudent and judicious use of herbicide could be tolerated. Good forest management will satisfy almost all of the requirements of certification. So it isn't anything that we have to fear.
Marshall Pecor agrees. As chief forester for the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, Pecor has had frequent meetings with certifiers.
I think it's usually a time of lively discussion about new principles, new ideas. Ideas that we sometimes thought about that maybe we kind of drag our feet on. Certification has kind of given us the push to move forward with these things.
Certification is new for the Menominees, but they take pride in 140 years of sustainable forest practices. When timber barons left the rest of Wisconsin's forest in shambles, the Menominees managed their timber so they would always have something to cut.
What Menominee really represents is that we can manage a large resource, take commodities, derive income from it, and still have a pristine looking forest. Clean air, clean water, and spiritual feelings from the forest. And we got more timber now than when we started.
The forest and the Menominee Lumber Mill also provide jobs for many tribal members.
Every year, the value that we get, the dollar and cents that we get from being certified is increasing.
At the annual Menominee powwow, colorfully dressed dancers wind among beautiful pine trees. Around them, the tribe's certified forest stands tall and pristine.
There's old people come back that have left you and say, we still got a forest?
Yeah. In Minnesota, discussions between timber managers and environmentalists have led to widespread certification of public lands.
I would say about 30% of the county land is being certified, and then the next 2 to 3 years, more than half of the land probably will be certified over that time period. Every meeting I go to, certification at the national and local level is an issue, and people are moving towards it. Public agencies are moving toward it.
That's good news to Andy Shaw, the owner of a lumber mill in Canada.
We need to...
So it's sort of a small thing that all of us can do when we're thinking of lumber purchases to see if we can get certified wood. Interestingly, it doesn't cost much more at all. One of the interesting things is that the retailer of wood in the world is the Home Depot company, and 2 years ago declared that it would move toward as much certified wood as possible, and with the eventual aim of selling only certified wood. Right now, the supply is not large enough. There are simply not enough forests providing certified wood for Home Depot to come anywhere close to that. But they've been one of the And as a result, some of the other companies like Lowe's have followed their lead and said, if we can get it, we will go toward certified wood as well. In Europe, certified wood is much more prevalent than here in the United States. There's much more of a push for it in the European Union. Within the next 5 years or so, is hoping to have a requirement for certified wood for virtually everything. But here in the United States, it still represents only about 1% of the wood that's on the market.
What did you say about this?
Yes.
Just a personal note, we have an interesting property in Clark County, and our son manages that, and he recently has gotten his, certification.
And I think 5 years, it's all managed carefully.
And they just go in and they got this kind of gad big thing. It just goes in and it just takes individual trees out that are ready to harvest, and then they replant. And something about the Smartwood is part of what...
Smartwood is the certifier, probably here in the Washington area. So that would be the group that would come out and do the certification. And interestingly, in a company like Collins Pine, which you saw, which operates in Northern California and in Oregon, it's actually a Portland-based company, they don't have to plant any trees. They don't plant trees. It all comes from the trees that are there and are naturally provided seeds because of the selective logging practices. Now, there's an interesting irony to all of this, which is, I think, a warning to those of us in the environmental movement and the environmental community to be somewhat careful about the things that we jump to supporting. There is currently an initiative on the ballot in California, which is being promoted by, God love her, a wonderful person, Julia Butterfly, whose name may be familiar to some of you. She's the young woman who spent 2 years on the top of a redwood tree, living on top of a redwood tree to protect it. And she's one of the most wonderful people you would ever meet. I've met her on a number of occasions. But she has an idea that I think could be rather disastrous, and that she's trying to get on the ballot. The initiative, which is called, it's an old growth, it's a fly. It's the California Old Growth Initiative, and under that initiative, any old growth tree in California, you couldn't cut an old growth tree, and an old growth tree would be defined as any tree that was a standing tree before California became a state in 1848. So that's roughly a 150-year-old tree. And also, you couldn't cut any tree that was larger than... This guy is persistent. you couldn't cut any tree that's over 30 inches in diameter, and you couldn't cut any tree that was within 50 feet of an old growth tree. It sort of sounds like an environmentally friendly law, but the people who would hit it, a company like Collins Pine, which has deliberately selectively cut and has left many, many old growth trees. In fact, it cuts trees when the trees begin to look unhealthy, when they're not producing the cones and other kinds of things, and it takes them out selectively, and it leaves the best wood that will take them out later. So they've got everywhere there's old growth trees, and if this initiative passes, Collins Pine wouldn't be able to cut on about 90% of its timberlands, because that you would be within 50 feet of an old growth tree. And the other thing about it is that if an initiative like this passes, it could lead the companies to simply cut everything that's under 30 inches, I mean, to make sure it doesn't get to 30 inches in the first place, and also to cut as fast as they could prior to the initiative becoming law, so it could backfire and have all the opposite effect. And it also, in a way, favors the companies that have already screwed up and cut all their old growth trees and now have just plantations and small planted trees. Their operations wouldn't be affected. So it's sort of a lesson that
one hand, these are complicated matters, and there aren't simple answers to a lot of them. And sometimes the companies that are doing the best job could be penalized by a law that's not well thought out.
What did you say about the five states? What did you say about five states that passed something, or you mentioned?
Oh, three states are moving toward having all their public forest lands go through this process and be certified, so that they want their forests to be managed sustainably. And those states are New York, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota. And Washington was about to become the fourth, but now probably will not. Next clip, I've got two more short clips to show you. And the next two are about people who have kind of positive stories of people who have done small things to preserve habitat for wildlife and natural lands in their area. And the first comes from my most recently completed program, which is called On Nature's Terms. And it's a documentary about the importance of those animals that a lot of us would rather not have around, the big predators, the grizzly bears, mountain lions, wolves, and so forth, and the necessity of preserving habitat because these big predators are very essential and important to the whole ecosystems of which they are part. And it's not simply enough to preserve large tracts of land. This is one thing that biologists are discovering now, that it's not enough to preserve a tract of land to keep up populations of these predators. You have to be able to connect large areas of land with corridors to other large areas so that the animals can migrate back and forth. Otherwise, the gene pools become too small. And just like a gene pool that becomes too small for human beings, it has a very negative inbreeding effect on the animals and can ultimately lead to their extinction. So this is a story of a wonderful thing that took place in Southern California, right outside Los Angeles, and between Whittier and Riverside. There's a place called Clark Canyon. And a woman, an activist, who just decided she wanted to save this place and brought all of her neighbors and other people together and created a whole movement that made that possible. So it's a short film, and I'll let it run about a couple minutes after the part about her is done, because there's kind of an appeal to the city.
And by saving big wildlands, you can save wolves.
Saving big wildlands is necessary for the protection of all predators. But those areas must not be separated from each other as islands in a sea of development. That's a lesson Claire Schlotterbeck learned after she fought to save the open space near her home in Southern California.
This is one of the world's 20 hotspots for biodiversity. There's more variety of life in this region than any region of comparable size in the country, which makes it a hotspot. And it's a hotspot because it's falling apart, being threatened by development.
Claire lives on the edge of the Chino Hills, grassy rolling country north of the high tree-covered Santa Ana Mountains. The Santa Anas are part of Cleveland National Forest, while the Chino Hills are protected by a state park Claire fought to create back in 1980. 15 million people live within an hour's drive of the airport. The state park and national forest are separated by a busy freeway and by this deep arroyo called Coal Canyon. For wildlife, Coal Canyon provides what ecologists call connectivity, the corridor between large protected open spaces.
And they all use this river of life to flow from a big, large open space of the Cleveland National Forest to Chino Hills State Park and beyond.
A few years ago, a major housing project was planned for the lower part of Coal Canyon. Biologist Paul Beyer and park ranger Gary Hunn warned conservationists that the development would block predator migration dooming mountain lions and bobcats and threatening the entire ecosystem.
It made me realize that everything I'd worked for the last 20 years as a volunteer in establishing Chino Hills State Park was at risk, and that unless we connected Coal Canyon to the Cleveland National Forest, everything I'd spent 20 years working on would be gone.
So Claire looked for a way to stop the proposed subdivision. She persuaded other people to come and see Coal Canyon and join with her in the effort to save it.
And we formed a very big coalition to help stop the development and purchase the land. But it was very expensive land because it was entitled and ready to build.
In fact, they had to raise $50 million to buy the land. They got it from individuals, corporations, municipalities, foundations, and the state park system.
We had to fight for every dollar.
November 2000. Claire Schlotterbeck and her fellow activists celebrate victory as Coal Canyon is officially added to Chino Hills State Park, guaranteeing that predators will always have a corridor between the hills and the high Santa Anas. Citizen action to save the canyon was a resounding success. Perhaps more importantly, it was a victory for the principle of connectivity.
And it redefined state parks priorities. In fact, because now they're the first state agency to get it. They understand that all the state parks they've saved are at risk unless they connect them to other large open spaces.
And I hope it can serve as a real inspiring example to say, okay, let's look at the map. Where do we go next?
We need to set aside more land now. It's never going to get any cheaper. By any standard, 50 years from now, the land that we would buy today is cheap. You often hear from politicians that there's no money to do these kinds of things. There is money for anything we place priority upon. Even in the inner cities, they're saying we want more parks. We want places to recreate. We're worried about the mental health of our children. We're worried about the discipline and the delinquency problems of our children, and we see parks, we see refuges and wildlife areas to take our children to teach them different values than they learn in a concrete jungle.
We're going to play a predator-prey game right now, and the coyotes have to bring their prey over to their den.
These Orange County, California school children are learning nature's values through a game that lets some of them be predators and the rest prey. They discover how important predators are to the delicate balance of nature. They will understand more deeply than did generations before them why saving land and wildlife matters. From Los Angeles to Yellowstone, from the southern Rockies to the northern Appalachians, Americans are learning that people and predators can coexist in harmony and balance.
We've already witnessed a revolution. Going from seeing them as commodities, as just meat on the hoof, to where we genuinely cherish them. We've done lots of things for them. And I think there's no reason why that transformation has to stop now. I think it's going to continue. And that's going to be the salvation of a large part of us.
Ultimately, the decision to save predators is not just about science. It's about us, about our values and the maturity of our civilization, about our appreciation of the right of all species to live freely on this earth. We can assure that our children and all children to come inherit a world still filled with the beauty, magic, and power of these wild animals. It's up to us.
How did you get those marvelous animal shots?
Yeah, those are fabulous.
Well, I wish I could say that I was out there. I actually know some of the top wildlife photographers in America who shot them, particularly a fellow named Bob Landis, who's a National Geographic photographer and lives in the Yellowstone area. He gave me lots of stuff. So, wildlife photography is something that I've never done. I've got a lot of patience,
I don't have a lot of patience. You really have to kind of be out there for just a long time waiting for animals. And I tend to do more with, you know, human stories and character stories and so forth. So I had to get my... part of this program, a good part of this program takes place in Yellowstone. And I did have the wonderful opportunity to go out looking for wolves. And with people, and we saw wolves. They're kind of a long ways away, so the shots we got of them were not very good, unfortunately. I got other stuff in my work just to make up for that, but it was just a great experience to actually see the wolves at all and to hear them. And then I went, had the opportunity, one shot we saw at the Edwards Park made absolutely no sense. The bit of the show that you saw was this guy standing with a radio up on a hillside. But actually, that if you saw the whole film, that's a fellow named Seth Riley, who's a national park biologist in the Santa Monica Mountains National Recreation Area outside Los Angeles. And I had the opportunity of going with Seth around tracking bobcats, which were collared. And we got much closer and got actually good shots of the bobcats, which was sort of a neat experience. And especially to see that they were so close to these suburban houses, and people had no idea that they were really right there, you know, and survived. I love my, the Jay from Collins Pine, Jay Francis said, job. I love my job in the sense that I get to meet so many wonderful people and go learn these kind of stories and tell people stories and go around. It's a great delight to me to be able to do that and to let more people know of some of the neat things that are really going on out there that we don't hear about because we get so much of the bad news. And we ought to get the bad news because we need to know what's going on, but we need some of the good news also. The last clip I'm going to show is a documentary that some of you may have seen called Escape from Affluenza, the follow-up to my program Affluenza. And it's just a short bit about an evangelical theologian named Cal DeWitt, who also is a, Cal is an interesting guy because he's both a very, very religious man, a theologian, an evangelist, but also he's a scientist. He teaches biology at the University of Wisconsin, and kind of combines these two things that are sometimes seen as opposite extremes. And Cal has been very concerned about people learning about the environment and about the importance of stewardship and what we're called on to do to preserve God's earth. There was, this is not in this particular piece, but it's an interesting story about Cal. When Congress was debating whether or not to extend the Endangered Species Act, Cal DeWitt and a number of other evangelicals who were also environmentalists went to Congress, and actually Cal brought a cougar with him. And they had a press conference, and Cal told the story of Noah's Ark and used it as an example of why God calls us to save and preserve biodiversity, and pointed out that God didn't tell Noah to take only the valuable animals and the ones that we eat and farm, but every living species to carry on. And made this talk and actually persuaded, I think, a number of very conservative religious Congress people to change their mind and vote in terms of extending the Endangered Species Act. One of the funny stories is that Cal told me was that he had this cougar, and they were at the press conference, and there were all the media, kind of all the TV people. If any of you have seen, we have microphones that often have a long pole and big fuzzy big fuzzy microphone right there. So they're all, the TV people are all together, the microphone's trying to get in close to see if the cougar's going to talk. And a cougar thinks this thing is a rap, you know. It's like biting his microphones. Sounds like it was a wonderful scene. The media people were a bit shocked to have the large fangs the cougars have go right into their expensive, and they are expensive, microphones. Anyway, this little last piece about Cal DeWitt and his work, and what Cal tells us in this, I think, is that we need to understand and get in tune with the natural places right where we live, because there's magic in the place where we live. And even though it's wonderful to come to Holden, and this is a great place to be, there are natural places of great magic and wonder where we live as well. Okay.
I'd better figure that out as well.
Oh wow, look at this. Here is one of the really rare plants of the wetland. Here is the small water parsnip, very long.
It's things like this that really affect me, because it instills in you some sense of awe and wonder. And I think that awe and wonder is really the thing that we're missing today.
When Cal DeWitt looks for a little excitement, he goes to the marsh instead of a movie or a mall.
This kind of awe and wonder you carry with you.
He can identify more than 80 birds that live in this wetland by their calls alone. He marvels at the flight of sandhill cranes, the texture of grass, and the work of beavers.
From the break of dawn to noon, on through to the setting sun, and then on into the night, there are absolutely dramatic changes. As you stand for a while, things begin to unfold if you're quiet enough to watch and listen. And after a full day, and you're not tired either, you tend to be exhilarated from the experience. But perhaps most curiously of all, you come home with your wallet just as full as when you left. And you've gotten all this pleasure, education, understanding, peace, for not a single penny. One also begins to understand something about how the world works. Perhaps the most dramatic thing you learn is how much human society, our current human society, works at cross purposes with the very principles that we learn here in the wetland. We tend to see the world as a one-way flow, from producer to consumer to trash bin to landfill. And here, everything is recycled. When a stalk of the cattails drops down to the marsh, it's just converted again into soil.
For 11,000 years, since the end of the last ice age, Wabeza Marsh has been working like that. All things in the marsh are part of the cycle of life. Nothing is wasted. Cal DeWitt walked through these wetlands with a certain sense of satisfaction. 25 years ago, this marsh was threatened by development. At the time, Cal was chairman of the tiny township of Dunn, Wisconsin.
We declared a moratorium on all land division in our town for 2 years, and we came up with a stewardship plan.
They stopped unplanned urban growth at the edge of Wabeza Marsh and worked together to restore the already damaged wetland to its natural state. Cal DeWitt is something of an anomaly, a scientist and professor of environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin. He is also a theologian and a deeply religious man.
The scriptural teachings really are kind of turned on their head by our modern consumption philosophy. Consume more, then you will be happy. The scriptural view is honor God, take care of creation, deal your bread to the hungry, and then joy comes as a byproduct of service. We try to short circuit that in our modern society by pursuing first joy, and of course we miss it.
Our consumer culture teaches us that newer is better.
hour-long thing you do a year.
How many hour-long do I do a year? I usually only average about 1 hour-long piece a year, and then I do a lot of small pieces, news stories, short. I do pieces that are not designed primarily for television, that are for nonprofit organizations and other groups that ask me to do them. And that would be this show on predator conservation was actually for a group called the Wildlife Network. I think it will go on public television because it's the right length, and I think they're going to like it. But it wasn't originally planned that way. The sustainable forestry piece is, as I mentioned, being produced for this big conference, international conference in Atlanta, Georgia. And if at this point, it's just a 13-minute video, but we're planning to use it as a sample tape to try to do an hour-long show for PBS on that subject, and I think the Ford Foundation is going to support that. Any other questions or comments? That's about all.
Yes. Does the National Forest Service ever consider this type of policy?
There are people who are really trying hard to get the Forest Service to think in terms of certification, and actually some of the companies like Collins Pine and others wish the U.S. Forest Service would move in that direction. At this point, the Forest Service intends to allow others, of course, to do the hardest thing and bid out to various companies. But they could do it. Actually, if there was public, if people knew about this and people wrote to Congress and the same thing to state governments. Forest Service, the U.S. Forest Service could do this relatively easily because most of the forests are still in reasonably good shape at this point, and they would assure that they would remain that way. Otherwise, I think we get it to this complete position of extremes, and the one side, one point where I don't agree with David Brower, my hero in so many ways, but I'm not in complete agreement with the position that says we should never cut anything in the national forest. I think there's an argument to be made for sustainable yield forestry that can provide things that people need but can do it, not in the ways that it's done with the huge clear cutting and destructiveness and so forth, but do it the way a company like Collins Pine does it. And yet still save clearly, and I still think it's absolutely important that we save large areas of old growth timber and so just for themselves, because here in the Northwest there's so little left. Yes?
In that line, what you say about clear cutting, not clear cutting, and also not leaving snags and brush, like what it said, in light of the recent fires, might be better to avoid some of that.
To avoid leaving the
Snags and brush.
Well, you know, the snags and brush and things, though, are needed clearly for the healthy ecosystem. Fire is a natural thing, and fires that what we can do, and unfortunately, one of those was not done well. You all know about the Los Alamos fire, but the whole idea of controlled burning to mimic natural systems, and companies like Collins have done that successfully for a long period of time. Actually, very limited controlled burns, so that you. But if you simply take all that stuff out of the forest, you leave very little opportunity either for the forest to regenerate itself, or for the wildlife to have decent habitat. Anyone else? Yes?
Right or wrong, I heard some distant time ago that some species of trees do not regrow until there has been a burn, and then their seeds will take root.
Well, it's true. I mean, there are definitely trees that don't like shade, pines in particular, and are not trees that do well in shady situations and so forth. But what people do is they clear cut everything and then they do plantations of pines.
But the healthier forests overall are the forests that really have a mix of trees. And if you go to a forest like on the Menominee Indian Reservation, which was a great, a neat experience for me, because years ago, I lived in Wisconsin and actually went to school in Madison, but I came to Wisconsin initially as a youngster to be a VISTA volunteer on the Bad River Indian Reservation. It's a Chippewa reservation in northern Wisconsin. So I spent a couple of years there. After that, the field director for VISTA for Wisconsin Indian Reservations. And so at that time, I went many times to the Menominee Reservation to supervise VISTA volunteers who were working on that reservation at the time. But I didn't know anything then about Menominee forestry or any of that kind of thing. I mean, I was completely oblivious to what they were doing. So it was neat to come back to that place 25 years later, and more than 25 years later, 30-some years later, and find out that there's a really remarkable story of the Menominees and what they did. And it really was a situation where Wisconsin was leveled, I mean, by companies like Weyerhaeuser before they moved out to the Pacific Northwest. But the Menominees didn't do that, and they kept their forest in good shape, and they have many, many kinds of trees. They, on the forest, in small areas, you see 14 different types of softwood and hardwood trees all growing in the same area. And yet it's been very profitable for them.
Mm-hmm. One of those trees that she's talking about is the lodge pole pine. If you've been out in Yellowstone, you remember the fires there. We did an elder hostel there last spring, and they told us it requires 128 degrees to burst the pine cones on those trees so the seeds can be spread. And you look at those areas now where that fire was, I guess it's like 5 years ago, there are trees 4 and 5 feet tall.
Oh, yeah.
That have grown up and where that fire was. And some people, they said, asked, well, aren't you going to clear all those dead trees out of there, the ones that were down by the fire? And no, you leave that, as you said, that's part of the ecosystem. And all of the little critters, the bugs, the animals, they all rely on that for part of
the whole health of the soil and everything.
The whole thing, yeah. You know, so you don't clear them out. And I know that the Park Service and others have taken that stand now, but it's a very natural thing. It happens.
Yeah, I think actually our government agencies these days are pretty enlightened about their management practices, and they take actually a lot of flack for it. Unfortunately, because people aren't aware of it. But the biologists that are working for the parks and the forests and stuff, the Forest Service, for example, is full of really good biologists and people who want to protect the forests and who want to reduce. Part of my story in the Predator program is about a forest ranger in the Gallatin National Forest near Yellowstone who has been making all these road closures, simply removing roads that are scattered all over and letting them go back to the natural state. Still leaving a fair number of roads so that people can enter the forest, but trying to reduce that somewhat because roads are a real threat to wildlife. And people who do that take an immense amount of flack. There have been, I think, just in the state of Nevada alone in the last couple of years, there's been well over 100 attacks on Forest Service personnel by people who either didn't want them to close the road or that. So it's frightening. And the forest administrator of the Humboldt National Forest in Nevada, a woman named Linda Flora, who took over a very, very progressive forestry manager, became the head of that national forest. Eventually was forced to resign and to leave because she had so many threats on her life from so-called wise use movement people who didn't want any limits put on their use of the forest for various things, and off-road vehicles, snowmobiles, and cunning, hunting, whatever they wanted to do. They felt that this was their land and the government had no business telling them what to do. So it's tough to be one of these people and do that.
But what you were saying about the cones and the seeds is, it's very true. Many, many species require fire. And particularly the biggest trees in the world, the giant sequoias, which many of you have seen in California. I mean, they simply do not, the seeds do not get out without, out of the cones to regrow giant sequoias without fire. It is a part. It's an interesting thing. I mean, this is the world is so connected, and the plan is so complex. And
the public gets so upset because after fire, when they come back and it doesn't look, Yellowstone doesn't look like it did in 1945 when they were there with their mom and dad. You know, it's like it's lost.
But the problem is, if you don't do some of these kind of things and you don't have that, then you get these really enormous and tragic fires that end up being hugely disastrous. And also, people want to build right next to it. I mean, more and more people want to build on wetlands that flood, and they want to build by forests that burn, and then they want to be sure that nothing happens to what they build.
Shakes his head. He said, "They build, you know, they let them build this far, you know, from the edge of the river, and then everybody's supposed to go out and save one of their pumps, you know."
Yeah. There's one case, I can't remember the state now, where somebody has received like federal flood assistance 36 times. Well, there's still an immense amount of clear cutting going on. I think Oregon, there are companies there, some of the most progressive companies are in Oregon. Collins Pine is based there, Roosevelt is based there. And certainly the governor of Oregon, Chuck Kirchhoff, is very conservative. Well, thank you all.